Well, when I mentioned that he was dictatorial,
this is Barney Roos.
Barney Roos, yes. And all fairness, I liked the man. I want to make that sure we all did. And he just had some very, very strong opinions, and especially in engineering, where the so-called styling was done. Now, what we had done when we came in, and we were only there a very few years, we had two outside influences to design against. Brooks Stevens was an outside consultant, and got along very well with Brooks Stevens. And Alex D. Sokonofsky of fame. Remember the marvelous cars that he made for Esquire magazine back in those days?
Do you remember the spelling of his name?
S-A-H-K. We'll have to go over that. Oh. We'll have to do it because I can't really recall
it.
Sokonofsky. Sokonofsky. And what we had done, Kibitzer and myself and a couple of others I forget now, we had beaten out the outside competition. We had worked very hard, and we had some beautiful renderings that were to scale. Our competition did not use scale. Rook Stevens, all this wild stuff. That
grandiose.
Well, it was no way that you could put it into model form from what you saw. And we it was quite apparent on our stuff that was more in the ballpark. So Barney Roos came down one day as soon as he had heard the news that the new line on the Lincoln was cut down for inventory reasons within 2 months after they got into production. And he came down and explained, "I can't stand automobile designers, you know? And this is what you do." You know, a blanket statement covering all designers, you know. He was, in his way, telling us exactly what status we had within the company. And the development went on. And then, of course, during this period, I'd known Preston Tucker a bit, you know, and I'd seen him down in Indianapolis. We would, during that period, I'll tell you, we had a wonderful thing that happened that was good for all designers from the Detroit area, Detroit Toledo area. As I mentioned before, very few of the designers knew who each, you know, you weren't acquainted with other companies, but they would have race train. A train would form up in Detroit and go to Indianapolis overnight for the race the next day, and then that was loaded with automobile designers. It just happened that. So we had a ball, and that's how we got acquainted with each other, is this unofficial get-together. Because companies did not encourage that. They, especially the GM crowd, was very aloof which formed their pattern of behavior forever. They were, except to right up to recently, it was a very aloof group, and so I was.
You think that was Harley Earls doing?
I believe so. Yes.
Yeah, probably.
Yes, I believe. Yes, he was had some very positive, and he had a developed a very definite direction that way. So we had those wonderful trips. And toward they were trying to unionize the designers at Willys Overland, and I objected to this very much, and it was a much stronger union town there than Detroit at that time. So I decided to leave there, and I did developed from the outside, a new Tucker to follow the torpedo.
Really? As a consultant?
Yes.
Who did you work with on that, or work for?
Preston Tucker.
Directly with Preston?
Now, this was not an official program. This was merely to qualify for their group. Because, as you know, Alex Tremulous was in charge and did a beautiful job down there. And I just wanted to join the staff. That was the whole idea. And I decided to leave the Willys Overland, and I had my modeler, Kurt Boehm, B-O-E-H-M, he'd left and had gone down to Raymond Loewy in South Bend. So I was making a pitch for both companies.
Mm-hmm.
And Tucker went out, and I joined Raymond Loewy in South Bend.
How did that come about? Did Boehm give you a...
He gave me a very good recommendation, and they were building the staff down there.
Right.
See, their staff was very low, too.
Yes.
And so I joined them in the spring of 49.
Did you meet Loewy prior to joining the staff?
No, I'd heard him at an SAE conference where he was telling about the development of the post-war,
right.
The first Loewy coup.
Very charming.
Very charming man. I was very impressed by him. Then, of course, when I went down there, I met him within a week or so after I'd arrived, and we had a long association.
Good.
That ran up into the Avanti and the Avanti II, which is the four-door. Very exciting car.
What year did you join Studebaker?
'49. Spring of '49, I left Willys Overland, went down to South Bend, and then immediately started on, we were working on the all-new car, the 53. I got there within a few months of preliminary work. Each designer was given a quarter-size model and a modeler, and we did our version of this new experimental car. Because Mr. Loewy had sold Mr. Huffman that, in the 50s, already this GM had been doing some of the advanced study cars,
right.
For the Autorama.
Right, the traveling unit.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So here we were supposedly, being a very, very far out group, which we were, but the famous, the 53, as we see up there, that that
right.
came from this initial study.
Did it?
Yeah, that all the designers.
Studebaker what was it called? The
Starlight.
Starlight, that's right.
Yeah.
Starlight Coupes.
And so I worked closely and worked all the way through that program.
Excuse me, I'm one of these people who needs to tidy up one period before you go on to another.
Oh, yes.
The atmosphere at Willys was a bit medieval and...
Absolutely.
Yes, and it must have been very stultifying to...
It was, because we had no status at all,
corporate
status. Mm-hmm. Although we worked directly for the top management, Barney Roos was our head.
Mm-hmm.
We had the hostile draftsman. The UAW thing was extremely tight there.
Awkward relationship.
Other than that, it was very interesting. Gordon McKenzie helped make that company interesting.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't even in our department.
Mm-hmm.
Davison was a good friend of McKenzie. He was a sales promotion manager, a very dynamic man. Marcel DeMuller was our foreign representative. He was killed a couple of years later in an air crash. So I can say it was, Willys Overland was a very high point again,
mm-hmm.
in as far as my career, is finding out how influential and how important data from the field,
right.
The correct data, not
yeah.
fictitious stuff. I mean, the marketing information.
So in that sense, it was a step up.
It was a step up.
From your previous situation.
Absolutely,
yeah.
As far as
we need more of a matrix.
Because we had no sales department contact at Hudson at all.
Right.
It was
yeah.
all blind flying.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a step up.
And of course, you had this enormous built-in popular product, the
Jeep.
Post-war Jeep, and then the Jeepster.
Yeah, the Jeepster.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it was the first experience I had on a critical personnel situation where the production line started, pre-production, like the first 25 Jeeps. We had a vibration setup in our quarter panel, which was certainly a normal situation to be tightened up. And the new vice president in charge of engineering, body engineering, came in. I was an ex-Ford or GM man. I don't recall his name now. But to establish authority, he was a head of the chassis division and engine development.
Yeah.
And to establish authority, he fired Ed Schutte. Because of this thing that happened on the line that was absolutely a normal refinement or problem that you had.
Taken care of right on the line.
And it was taken care of. He took care of it, but it was the first time I'd seen a good friend fired.
Out of hand, yeah.
Given a half hour to leave the premises. A fine gentleman with a great reputation. So it was part of exposing the real world.
It
to me.
Soured you on your situation.
Well, yes, it did. It gave you, it certainly was another revelation of that we really don't have much clout in this, and it doesn't look like we're going to grow in importance in this company.
One last question. Who actually conceived the idea of taking the wartime Jeep, which I think had a couple of years in its wartime
fitting guys,
but then somebody decided, and I think very astutely, that this should be at least fashion for the passenger, close to the passenger vehicle that we have today, the half truck, half
oh yes,
half recreation vehicle, passenger car, known as the Jeepster.
The initial thinking on the Jeepster was definitely Brooke Stevens.
Was it?
Oh yes, I would give him credit for that. And the polished up station wagon,
yes.
With the cane and all that. That was
yes.
Ralph or Art Kibitzer and myself. We were out to make that, and then also that was with full agreement of the sales department. Oh, my name Lund at that time, and. Gordon McKenzie. They were pushing it very much. You see, we had quite a full line of Jeeps. We had a Jeep station. We had the Jeep fire engine at that time. And then we had, of course, opened the gate on color for the civilian
right.
Jeep. So we had one little delivery warehouse across from the administration building with just a very small opening. And every Jeep that was manufactured during that time, whether it was for the Bolivian Navy or who had, would pop out of this little doorway, and it was like seeing a toy shop, a miniature toy shop. And
every 30 seconds.
Every 30 seconds, this stuff would come out like toothpaste. You know, all these marvelous Jeep. Ben Gummersall, who was body build up. For Hudson was in charge of Willie's Overland that
was
time
it?
In the experimental garage. So
uh-huh.
we had actually a neat group.
Yeah, sounded like it. Yeah.
And then the Chevrolet, the GM crowd came in, and then there was a Ford crowd that came in.
Uh-huh.
So you can imagine what kind of the inner political thing that developed Lloyd's Overland in a very short time. And but my interest at that time was developing, qualifying for Tucker. I did qualify for it. It was fine with him, but the company folded up that week. But I'd approached Ford Motor Company during that period. You were having a strike, I remember. The only strike you'd had for a long time for all of engineering in the summer of 49, I believe it was.
Yes.
Yeah. Because they were developing a Continental division.
Right.
And applied for that.
Do you remember who you talked to?
Yes. Was there a man, Olson, or something like that?
Oswald,
John Oswald.
He'd come over from GM. He was the administrative head.
That's right. He and
George Snyder was the design head.
Yes, yes. I talked with those two. And in fact, they didn't know it, but they were looking at a new Tucker. That I used as a sample.
Portfolio.
Yes.
But you were happily, it came to rest in a very congenial atmosphere in South Bend.
Yes, that was exciting because.
Can you tell us why it was exciting?
Yes, the reason it was exciting is that Mr. Lowy had the only international design department in the United States at that time. In other words, we had Count Albrecht Goertz, we had John Cuccio from Italy. Goertz from Germany. C-U-C-C-I-O, one of the finest designers and one of the least known in this country. I found this quite to be true, that the unknown people over this period were very effective as far as I was concerned, and some that we had them from England. We had about every country. We had from France. We had one designer from Cairo, Egypt. And so it was really an international. It was the thing that excited me. It was the first time that I had an opportunity to compete directly with European designers, and that was the hallmark. That I was extremely happy with that because one of the things. One of the parts of being a designer, it's very, very individual, yet there were very few schools at that time. Parsons was the only one in the United States for that type of art education, and most of the automotive designers prior to the World War II were from the architectural, School of Architecture. And
they really hadn't established schools for industrial design.
No, not yet, not at this point. And so Mr. Lowy had been one of the great ones that had really developed product design, you know, to a high form. And
had been brought in, I think, just before.
He came in 39.
38, 39
at Studebaker.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Huffman was a marvelous leader. It's too bad that he ever left Studebaker because some of the decisions that were made right after he left spelled the doom of Studebaker some years later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's early decisions. Usually there's a 10-year gap between critical decisions, no matter what the market is, that can set the decide whether a company fails or goes on. And I was very excited about the group. Bob Burke was the chief designer at that time.
Was he?
Have you met Bob?
I've talked to him on the phone. Yes.
Well, actually, terrific man. He was our head on the daily basis. And Mr. Lowy would come every week or 10 days or so and review. Bob had an, we had a very similar situation there. Engineering-wise, we had some very good people on our liaison, you know, and then we had some that were quite impossible, too. and then a limited top management relationship at Studebaker. When Mr. Huffman left, it was a real void because Mr. Lowy had such a good communication with him.
Yes, uh-huh.
And that's how that car, the 53, got into being. And incidentally, on the new Starlight Coupe, I ended up making a special one. It was one of my assignments to work up a special interior. And I remember it was a very dark blue with a French gray glove leather interior.
Ooh.
For Richard Rogers of Rogers and Hammerstein.
Really?
He's a good friend of Mr. Lowy's, and
oh.
I worked that car up for him. As far as we know, he never did drive. I'm sorry that I didn't follow the car up, because it just went out to Long Island, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know whatever happened, but I'd love to have had that car.
Yeah.
but I was working back and forth, even when I was in South Bend, to New York on special assignment.
Yeah, that's interesting that you you joined the Lowy Group, which had a very special kind of independent status. There.
Yes.
And, especially when he was working with
yes.
Paul Hoffman. But he would use members of the staff to work on his outside work.
Always did. Always did. And it was okay with the corporation.
That's good. That's
yes.
Very enlightened for that.
Yes.
This was his stature in the industry.
Absolutely. That was Mr. Lowy was the best that way. He operated a lot of people. Sometimes people criticize his Hollywood approach.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't. I never did. They say, "Well, how come? Well, Mr. Lowy, you have these drawings. He signs your drawings." Well, that was understood when you went with him. And his theory was to come into a board meeting of a client company,
mm-hmm.
and to be more famous than the chairman of the board. He better be known much more than in an established accreditation.
Yes, right.
That would very difficult because many people that come up through the managerial status through finance and everything have a great distrust and dislike for creative people.
Often
an inferiority, they show this anger through inferiority. So, mm-hmm. Mr. Lowy always, that's why he had this international reputation and the Hollywood reputation and New York thing, all to give his corporation an immediate status, and it was very, very successful
it
for years.
Stupid.
Sure, it did. The, we were dissatisfied at Studebaker on the line work relative that we wanted to develop more of a European product as far as the sales aspect too. We recommended not only new design, but we also recommended advertising, type of advertising which would have been extremely helpful. But Studebaker
yeah.
was tied in with some awful agency in Chicago that just, remember how corny these
oh, yes, yes.
these Kellogg cereal brand
mm-hmm.
ads that they
yeah.
had? Mr. Lowy tried to shake them loose on a lot of that, but the old guard, other than Mr. Hoffman, the old guard were very difficult to work with. In fact, we wanted and Mr. Lowy was encouraging a more expensive Studebaker and not to go to the bottom of the line
yes.
and not to have the cheap eight
yeah.
and the or that marvelous coupe that we had. They made a small six version of it.
Yeah.
See, we were against all that
right,
sort
yeah.
of crap.
Typical practices
turned out
of the industry.
Industry, yes.
Yeah.
And so special cars, I did a special Jaguar XK120 for Mr. Lowy while I was there.
Right.
And next thing was for Mattel, a new toy car.
Oh, really?
For them.
Uh-huh.
And then
we're becoming big business by this time.
Yes, and I'll show you the casting of that.
Yeah.
And then I was called in on Coca-Cola. The graphics.
Ferrari also.
Yes.
But what were you doing for Coca-Cola?
Well, this is for the trucks, the paint scheme on the trucks.
Oh, yes.
You know, because we did Shell Oil Company, we did, and I worked on that fine German glass or Chinaware. Oh, I forget.
Steubenware?
Not Steuben. It was China, fine German China. Oh, it starts with an H. I can't remember now. So I worked on a lot of different areas. A Fairchild, a turntable for Fairchild Corporation. You know, a commercial turntable for... so I was very fortunate.
That's
in that I had a great variety. And I did the first French battery clocks, battery electric clocks.
Oh, really?
In 1953.
Right.
That was another little private venture for Mr. Lilly. And I had a very good relationship with him, and one of the reasons, I believe, for that, since he was the John Barrymore of the thing, I never really tried to get to know him too well.
Yeah.
On a personal level, I'd seen that happen. It was disastrous for some people. And so we had a very good designer, and I went over to France with him later to develop the four-door, right after the Avanti was done.
Yeah.
And I guess the best compliment I can give Mr. Lilly, I don't know how the other designers, a couple of them felt the same way, but for this designer, Mr. Lilly was such a fine director that when you worked on a project for Mr. Lilly, it was the most important project going on not only in the United States but in Europe at that time. This is really important.
Right.
And that was very infused into me. I felt just great about it and did some of my best work for him. One of the projects happened in 1957, I believe it was, 56. But remember the Cornell safety car?
Yes.
Well, we were called in to do a version of that for Life magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cornell safety car itself was an ugly monster, and my job was to make a real appealing car.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Lilly was in France, and I was in New York, and we had phone conversations, and he got very uptight during the program. He could get really no more nice guy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I had a pretty good, I wouldn't get too rattled and take it too personally. And we got it to finish rendering. I did the whole thing, because you see, by this time, Lilly didn't have any design department left, automotive. I was the only one left in New York. I was the only one transferred from when the Packard Studebaker thing got together.
Right.
And we lost our studio in 54, 55. Yeah, the summer of 54, 55, the spring of 55, and I was transferred on to New York from that time on, and did some special cars for Lilly. And
but what, as you got there and you found this marvelous atmosphere and enthusiastic group, some of whom you'd worked with in the past and you knew by reputation, what was your first major assignment in the early 50s?
Yes, was preliminary design for the 53.
Starlight Coupe.
That's right. And
these were quite a departure.
See, we only had
in the industry.
Yes, very definitely. And again, we had our eye on the development, mechanical development, very much relative to Alfa Romeo and Maserati and all these people, and we Lancia, you know, the front wheel, tried to sell them on a front wheel drive unit, in fact. At that time, Ferry Porsche was over there. He did a new independent rear end for that car,
mm-hmm.
for the new four-door of that version, which I'll show you a picture of later.
Uh-huh.
So we had, we brought in some big guns,
mm-hmm.
you know. And of course, that was the beginning of the sports car craze in this country.
Beginning to describe the evolution of the Starliner Coupe, which was quite an innovation for its time.
It really was, yes.
Yes.
We had about eight staff designers, that is equal footing.
Mm-hmm.
And,
do you remember some of the names at that time?
Oh, yes. Ted Brennan, John Cuscio, Ed Herman, Vince Gardner, was famous in his own right, tremendous character. Robert Burke.
Mm-hmm. Who'd been there for some years.
Yes, and also I just saw him a few weeks ago at that automotive thing downtown. Bob Cotto.
Oh, yeah.
You know Bob Cotto? He was
Holden Bob
Holden Cotto. Holden Cotto.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very, very competitive. And, I did forget to mention one thing that's very, very important as far as Raymond Roy is concerned, being with him. I had done a lot of board work, that is, and portraying the new design and very tight rendering, I'd gotten that down pretty good. I wasn't there 4 days, and I was taken off the board immediately, put right into the clay. Best thing that ever happened to me. We designed in three-dimensional there. There was a difference between Raymond Loewy and General Motors, Ford, and the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
We had modelers. We had a big staff because we had a lot of full-size cars projects.
I think Cotto was a modeler, wasn't he?
And Cotto was a modeler. And I became a proficient modeler.
Mm-hmm.
And I prefer to work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And because you get the truth immediately, and you don't get second-hand representation. So we worked in the clay, and of course, we didn't have a union problem there.
Ah.
Big difference.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Loewy was scratched out to full size, you know. And so that development, you know, working in the round was the greatest boon to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I matured very fast there.
You could think three-dimensionally in those days.
Yes, and the competition, the type of men you were competing with,
mm-hmm.
were the best. It was, in simple form, to be with Raymond Loewy at that time was like being a member of the New York Yankees,
mm-hmm.
for the baseball group.
The best.
The best. And I enjoyed the input of we had top marketing people.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Loewy never overused marketing. In other words, never became a slave of it,
mm-hmm.
but used it as an absolutely viable tool.
Mm-hmm.
We had marketing people, but never too many of them, so that we had the best that could, because I would, we had Nabisco, Shell Oil, and all these different top companies, and you get tuned in. Silverware company, I didn't know anything about the silverware marketing, but I had the best man there to brief me on it.
Mm-hmm.
so I can go ahead and do a line of silverware.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be working on automotive. In fact, we did Air Force One, you know, for John Kennedy when he came in. We did that all in our little department.
Mm-hmm.
While that was being done while I was working on the Avanti.
Mm-hmm.
So we had tremendous excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Mr. Loy always had underemployment there, always understaffed.
Mm-hmm.
His product division. We had a 24-hour studio. That means you could come in any hour of the night you wanted to, or in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then 57. Another thing I learned in the New York aspect is no matter how important you were to a project, if that project ran out of money, Lowy had a low spot in 57, and I left and I went with another outfit for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Lowy operated like an advertising agency, that suddenly writers were paramount, you know, and you
mm-hmm.
had too much business or you didn't have enough at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we had our inner political fights between groups, the product group, packaging and whatnot, and then a new product man would come in and he didn't want the old timers to be there.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted his new group. We ran into all of that.
Oh,
but all in all, it was a very interesting experience.
And his method was to make you feel, each individual feel that you are contributing materially to
absolutely,
even more so, perhaps even creating on several levels.
Yes, yet he wouldn't get involved with you on the business level. I mean, you would not get the latest status of the financial condition, which fluctuated in his company. He spent so damn much money. That's what makes
yeah.
the top people, you know.
Yeah.
But it was, when you were dealing with Mr. Lloyd, it was strictly on the design job of that particular area that you were on. And
did Mr. Kippinger come with you?
No, he was strictly
out
of Detroit, and he stayed on Willits Overland several years, and then he went to Chrysler Interiors. He was working in fabrics, testing, and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
He ended his career there.
Mm-hmm.
And
so you're pretty much on your own by this point.
Oh, yes, yes.
So when you got there, you found that, to your surprise and delight, that you were assigned to a really, as someone described, I think Bob Burke, the really first post-war, new post-war car, new post-war car.
Yes.
Which would later become the Starlight Coupes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Did you work closely with Mr. Burke on those?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. He was director, and, you know, he was our chief.
He was the chief.
And he had all the problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's another thing about this. You know, you hear about what the hell is a chief designer?
Yeah, right.
Well, he's the guy that has all the problems, and the staff just has isolated
area.
Right. And later I became chief designer for Lowy in very few but very eventful years, where you have his ego to deal with and a new president of the company and a very, very short budget and a very short time to come up with a winner that you have to almost guarantee. Ridiculous, isn't it? You know? But very exciting, and it happened to work.
You had about, I guess, 2 years to put these together, didn't
yes,
you?
That's
yeah.
all. The two cars, two complete cars.
Mm-hmm.
The and to put an immediate production on that, the Studebaker, the Avanti. I don't have the figures on the timing right in front of me, but I think as a marketing man, information man like you, you'd be interested in the marketing approach on the Avanti. It took about two sentences in one little meeting in Palm Springs before we started on the car. As what are we aiming for? You've got to know where the heck you're going, and when you have a week or 10 days to develop and get approval on a new car, that is how tight we were on time.
Mm-hmm.
That direction could go any place, and you could miss, you know. And so I remember at the meeting, let's see, Mr. Lowy, myself, and Epstein was in charge of logistics and all that sort of thing. You know, the house we were working in and to get things for us. And I had a young designer, Tom Kellogg from West Coast. He'd just gotten out of Art Center there.
What was Mr. Epstein's first name?
John.
John, yeah.
And, but anyway, but just John and Mr. Lowy and myself, and I said, I remember vividly saying, now, we'll know when we've got the answer on this car. If we can see that, parked right on Palmdale Boulevard, right in Palm Springs, if it looks, we can visualize that car looking comfortable right on Palm Springs, one of the fine clubs, restaurants, and that's our criteria. And also, the first orders would be done by an airline pilot, which turned out we hit right on the nose. The first, in fact, the Avani Club was founded by a couple of airline pilots. And that was really no accident, because in preliminary thinking, and I'd done my homework on Egbert, the new president of the company.
Sherwin Egbert.
Sherwin. And I'd met him before he took over the company, just a few weeks before I made a point of meeting him. I was out of Studebaker at the time. And that meeting turned out to be very, very effective, because I knew him a little bit. And he knew, and I tipped him off that we didn't have any engines or any development to rely on. Coming in, that he was going into the presidency, and then Mr. Lowy called me after a few weeks and asked me to come down, or to not to meet in South Bend, to meet in Palm Springs. That's how quickly that was put together. And well, I had found out that Egbert was an aviation man, primarily, and a pilot. And I was an aviation man and enthusiast, and so that opened a very good understanding. So he, as a result of that, I'm very sure, because Mr. Lowy was concerned on who this guy Egbert was and how they were going to get along. Well, fortunately, Egbert did not try to become an automobile designer overnight, which has happened so much. When a new chief or executive officer comes in, he thinks he's got to know. And he did not try to know. And he okayed. It was his responsibility. He okayed a very fine car. And he was only helpful rather than any kind of hindrance at all. He said, this is it. And when he said this was it, that gave us authority. So the usual things that would have happened in engineering to cheapen that car, to screw it up, did not happen for that reason. In other words, that very expensive tooling on the front bumper, that went as is. We got the supercharger. We got Tony or Granatelli through the president of Studebaker. All this stuff fit into a very precise situation.
Unusual
for the time,
yes.
And the car just started to sell as they pulled it off the line. We knew there would be a good into the second year before the car would really start to catch on. And one of the reasons, again, a marketing situation, that we had in our disfavor on the Avanti was not the car itself, was that by the time the Avanti came out, there were very few good dealerships left in the country to sell them. We had a lot of back alley service station dealers that didn't even have room for one car. And by this time, Studebaker had lost a lot of dealers during that bad period leading, you know, from 58 through 1962. They were very slim times.
Yeah, right.
And they'd lost a lot of the dealerships. Mm-hmm. And so here we had a $5,000 car. And we had a bunch of dealers that didn't even know anyone that knew, had $5,000 for a car. In other words, those were top GM Cadillac prices.
Right.
So that was difficult. The sales platform was very, very difficult. I think the car would have done better had it, unfortunately, this is so extensive. At that time, remember, we had an affiliation with Mercedes-Benz.
I'd forgotten that.
Oh, yes. And a lot of people don't know what kind of an affiliation that was.
Mm-hmm.
We had full rights to all patents of Mercedes-Benz from the year one during that period that we did not take advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we could have been closer. We could have had twin dealerships. Had Studebaker insisted on it, to Mercedes-Benz. See, Mercedes-Benz joined Studebaker Corporation to reduce paperwork and a license for distribution and all that sort of, becoming part American company.
Right.
I don't know what percentage it was, but Studebaker, that was probably one of the prime mistakes of the 50s, is that they did not take advantage of their affiliation with Mercedes-Benz, that they could have.
Right.
And part of it was because of the very, the nature of Studebaker management felt very inferior to the Germans. That's all I can say. It was very obvious. There was very little cooperation, especially in engineering matters. And that was unfortunate. That was unfortunate.
Before we get into a detailed examination of the gestation of the Avanti, were you involved in any of those almost Byzantine intrigues involving Exner and Lowy and the rest of the executives at Studebaker in the 50s?
No, that had happened just before I arrived. When I arrived in 49, he had his small group.
That's right.
Out at the proving grounds.
Ed
Cole, and so we were competing with inside division.
Was Ed Cole part of that group?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not Ed Cole from GM, but the other.
Oh, the other, of course.
Yeah.
Engineer, yeah, right,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that lasted only one season. And then.
What did you say, Roy Cole?
Roy Cole. Yeah. Then Exner went on to Chrysler.
Right.
The Chrysler.
And that era disappeared.
That disappeared.
But then Hoffman was replaced, I believe, was he not?
Yes.
Was it Vance or?
Harold Vance.
Harold Vance.
Yeah.
Right.
And
we
had a. Yes, and we had that was that. That was cooled off a bit, and we still had the chief engineer though of he was an Easterner from MIT. Stanwood Sparrow was our chief engineer.
Stanwood Sparrow.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever hear of him?
No.
Well, he had been with in the development from the 25 on with Studebaker. Fantastic Bostonian type of guy. And one light there during that period of the 53 development that I was assigned to safety steering wheel setup. And that's one thing Mr. Lowy was very much involved in, going way ahead on things that were definitely needed. Whether the company asked for him or not at the time. But anyway, Stan Sparrow was the chief engineer. In other words, from your regular duties, you would be assigned a special.
Mm-hmm,
see?
Right.
And that was developed, this safety steering wheel. Now, if you recall, in the 1948, 49, 50, Studebakers, they had that bullet nose centerpiece was
right.
Terrible. I mean, that this is insanity.
Spinner. Yeah.
You know.
Was that Bob Burks, I think, wasn't it?
I'm afraid so.
Yeah.
And so here we've gotten up to the prototype and the shape and everything, which is not unlike the Mercedes-Benz wheel now, where we have the pad with a certain amount of, we spread the contact point over a greater amount of your chest.
Right.
But here Stan's, here we were working on that very problem, and Stan was killed running under a truck on the way back from Boston. Getting that through him, and 2 weeks later I was almost killed in the same injury, type of injury.
What's
pressed
the
chest from the steering
post? Steering
yes.
Column? Oh,
the steering column that
were you establishing some sort of a deep
dish and also the padded area,
mm-hmm.
and with the Studebaker medallion,
uh-huh.
you know,
right.
and thing. But isn't that ironic? The two men that were working on that problem, one of us on the safety. Safety was, I could never understand why it was such a sore point. Nobody wanted to. Well, our cars don't get in wrecks. I've actually heard at Hudson, we wanted a safety. I'll tell you how far ahead we were on that Hudson.
Uh-huh.
Even though the instrument panel was structural and part of the car, we wanted to, yes, use it as an integral part, but 6 inches or 7 inches in, and then the outer shell would be soft aluminum, like an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Frank Spring was all for this.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, where you would have an expendable, have any design you want on the instrument panel, but expendable soft aluminum
uh-huh.
that had the crushability.
Yeah.
So in the case of accident, you were not, and the company said, well, our cars don't get accidents. So, and the same with Studebaker. We had, Sheba, come. For instance, in that period, 1951 model, probably the most dangerous Studebaker of all, we had that first, we went into the V8 in 51,
oh,
remember?
Yes.
We had a very hot 289 engine, and we had the same brakes that was on the Champion 4 years before. So our cars were underbraked area-wise and effective. And 54, they finally beefed up the brakes a little bit so that they were adequate, but not good enough. But this was, the whole industry was underbraked.
Yes.
Remember.
Yeah.
The early GM, you know, the automatic brake system where you had the helper, you know, the the power brakes.
Right, yes, of course. Yeah.
Well, no, the GM stuff was too sensitive, and a lot of people were killed when they first started using the power brakes. They were built up too tight,
mm-hmm.
and with too loose a steering and the tight braking. And so,
power assisted,
yeah. And I know the corporation knew, because we had suits from the mountain estates where people had gotten in trouble, and it was practically ignored. I remember our engineer, Hardy. I remember when I got a 53, and I asked for the sample brakes that Bendix had built up some real good brakes for us. They had 10, 11 sets left. And I asked him for a set to put on my new 53. He said, "What? You have enough brakes on that car." He was very angry that I even suggested, and I went over, and unfortunately they had been all thrown out. But Raymond Loewy and his group designers, we were given credit for the aesthetic, and that was our responsibility.
Yeah.
But we were very hard at work bringing to their attention mechanical situations.
The old engineers
so.
Didn't want to be reminded.
No, they thought it was none of our business,
mm-hmm.
you know. And again, that was a provincial attitude,
mm-hmm.
like Hudson had a certain provinciality to it.
Mm-hmm.
And our whole corporate structure, including GM, had a provincialism,
mm-hmm.
as far as the mechanical advantage. And with the exception of one man during that period, Preston Tucker was not a provincial.
No, he was a real
and,
forward-looking thing.
That car was a good car. It would have been very fine. And the other program that was like the Avanti, and in my research, find out, and Gordon Gurry, you know Gordon, don't you?
Yes.
You've met him?
Yes, we met him.
Well, I talked with Gordon later, years later about this, that the cord that he did, mm-hmm. you know, they, that was a very, very fast program, too.
Oh, was it?
The Avanti. Mm-hmm. It took a little longer than that. But basically, the amount of personnel, Mr. Cord himself, what was his first?
E.L.
Cord.
Mm-hmm.
There's a man right there that was never shown in history, as great as he really was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He had an aesthetic eye, and he started American Airlines. He owned Lycoming Aircraft Engines. He owned Stinson Aircraft. He did all of these things at Auburn Cord Duesenberg, you know. Fantastic guy. Now, there's a deal where basically a financial man was both. He had a very, very good eye.
Right.
See?
Yeah.
And so in that case, in that area, and then the Cord didn't go any longer than the Avanti did. It was shut off.
Yeah.
Except for the Altman effort years later, you
yes.
know, or just a few years later.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we didn't realize, when I say we, meaning Mr. Lowy and myself, basically, didn't realize how far ahead the Avanti really was. We expected that to be passed up very shortly by GM or someone else. We just, and they're still using that for reference. A lot of the new cars are the car doesn't look odd on the road now, you know. It's the development, the most exciting development, was going to France right after the full size was put to get bed here,
mm-hmm.
In South Bend, using the modelers mm-hmm. that they had there for Subaru Corporation. We had the full size was put up there. I'll go back and forth between New York and. But I, that March of that year, that spring of 60 was, I went to France at the Chateau and worked on the four-door
mm-hmm.
That was to follow the Avanti. Now, this was a real ambitious project. That was a 150-mile-an-hour family car. This was to be the first of the American sports sedans.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Mr. Lowy, or Mr. Ferrari had contacted me through New York and offered, here Ford Motor Company was trying to get Ferrari interested in doing some work for him at that time.
Right.
And Mr. Ferrari found out, I think John Cuccio mentioned that we didn't have any engines. Cuccio wasn't with us at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in Italy, and Mr. Ferrari offered us one of three engines to develop under license, a V8, a V6, and a V12.
Were you able to take advantage of it?
And so I reported to the president. Mr. Lowy was out of the country, and I was gave Mr. Ferrari's card and everything, and I never knew, we never had a meeting after that. I never knew what transpired. Of course, Mr. Egbert immediately was ill toward the end and was out of commission, and that's when the old guard of Studebaker came in, back into the picture, and stifled our four-door that we had developed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that four-door, after the Avanti, was in direct competition with Brooke Stevens' car. Brooke Stevens had nothing to do with the Avanti project at all. He was working up the Hawk GT conversion at that time.
That's right, yeah.
But the four-door, to follow the Avanti, Brooke Stevens was in competition.
Mm-hmm.
And he figure I'd competed with him years before in 46, you know, on the Willie's Oval.
Yes, right.
And then we finally met each other.
Did you?
Yeah. And Mr. Lowy and Brooke Stevens, when I finally met him, he said, oh, you are the guy, you know. He said, how come one thing, we were at Carlisle, Pennsylvania,
oh, yes,
for a milestone meet, and
yes,
Bob Burt, and he said, why did Lowy always hide you? You know, we never saw you.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I don't know about that. But anyway, we had quite a competition all those years. And our company was strange. Lowy was very, very paranoid about one thing. And that was in relation to that experience with Exner.
Yeah.
And I was becoming quite effective in my work with Lowy, especially on the Abani, and he put some real distance between the two of us that made me feel rather bad toward the end of my time with Lowy there.
Yeah.
And he did not have to do that, because I was no threat to him at all.
Who was that?
Mr. Lowy.
Oh, Lowy himself.
Lowy, you know, suddenly, you know, in Madison Avenue, suddenly you have less work to do, or you're not called into the office, or he stops coming by, you know, things like that.
Do you view you as a possible another Exner?
Yes, I believe that would be the only thing, and
yeah.
I never talked when I was with Lowy. Everything was very, very confidential. That's part of the business. And then after I left, the company photographer with Lowy, he was the one that